Buffalo herd, you can't roller skate in the buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in the buffalo herd. But you can be happy if you've mind to.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, hosted Wednesday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at Bison Coffee House in Portland. The event will feature stories and songs about the last wild buffalo and information about the ongoing struggle to protect them. That's the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, Wednesday, September 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Bison Coffee House, 3941 Northeast Cully Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You can't roller skate the buffalo herd. You can't roller skate the buffalo herd.
Please join us for KBOO's annual meeting, Sunday, September 27th from noon to 4 p.m. at Portland State University's Native American Student and Community Center, 710 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland. The event will feature keynote speaker Joanne Hardesty and music from Bajo Salario Collective Band. Light refreshments will be provided. Board candidate ballots will be accepted until 2 p.m., and board election results will be announced at 3:50 p.m. Again, that's KBOO's annual meeting, Sunday, September 27th from noon to 4 p.m. at the Native American Student and Community Center at PSU. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the River Signal, so stay tuned.
Rainbow days in the sky turn dark.
The River Signal.
A long dash following 10 seconds of silence.
Rainbow days in the sky turn dark.
This summer, three of us, Galen, Brian, and Reed, are traveling down the Mississippi on the Channel Princess, a 30-foot paddle wheel riverboat. As we go, we're meeting musicians and recording them on boats and riverbanks, and then weaving their music into a serialized radio story. We pull together every episode of The River Signal in just 7 days, all while moving downriver and trying not to sink the boat.
The River Signal is fiction, set in a sort of weird alternate reality. And the world of each episode is inspired by the music we hear and the people we meet. We chose fiction because we don't quite believe in true travel stories. And we hope that by writing an obviously fictional account of our trip, we'll show how subjective travel stories can be.
After nearly 1,800 miles on the river, the Channel Princess arrives on a rainy day in September, through the Industrial Canal and into the heart of New Orleans. In the 4 months since we left home, we've recorded almost 30 sessions with musicians from Minnesota to Louisiana. We spend the last few days of our trip navigating the harsh industrial waters, dodging ocean freighters, and listening to our tapes from this summer. This episode is a tribute to those performers who shared their home, advice, stories, and music.
Trees blur by as I bound through the moss. I'm running from some unspeakable terror pursuing me through the mist. Trying to escape the forest, find my way back home, but these north woods seem shapeless in the fog. My lungs burn as I push faster, and somehow I know I can't escape it. Suddenly, a scaly tail wraps around my waist, and I'm plucked from the ground, my legs still kicking. The forest floor disappears below me as I'm wound up like a top, rolled into the body of a monstrous steel snake. I try to slip free, but the coils tighten, squeezing down on my chest. I have to fight the pressure. Breathe. I have to breathe. When I open my eyes, I see the wooden sides of a boat, covered in a thick brownish ooze. I roll onto my back, coughing and gasping for air. Huddling over me is Monty. She's breathing hard too, and completely soaked. Though her eyes are wrinkled in concern, she's smiling. I try to smile back, but my stomach churns and I roll back onto my side, spewing more brownish gunk into the boat. "Thought I'd lost you," I hear her say. I feel around and my fingers find the harpoon line, still tied around my waist. I trace it until I come to the severed end. The cut in the line is clean, like it was made with a knife. I look to Monty for an explanation. She just responds with a wink. She must have dove in after me, cut me free from the carp. I was sure that fish and I were going down together. But here I am, alive and breathing. "Did you see it?" I ask her. "Is it dead?" She doesn't answer right away, just looks down at me. Her eyes seem so different now. No longer taunting, but full of compassion. At last she says, "All that matters is that you aren't." I feel around and I find her hand, work it into my own. "Thanks for not letting me die," I say. She squeezes my hand and replies, "We're not out of this yet." Above Monty, I can see a whirling spiral of yellow and brown clouds. The whole sky looks bloated, like it's ready to pop. The storm is spinning faster and faster, sending powerful gusts across the river, rocking our little rowboat. Thick curtains of rain obscure the shoreline, making it nearly impossible to navigate off the river. Monty points us into the gale and bucks the waves as they crash into the hull. Water comes spilling over the bow, and I work quickly with a fish pan to scoop it back into the river. But the storm is overwhelming, and the water is coming in faster than I can bail. Each wave that hits us pushes the boat deeper into the river. I glance at the mast, and then at Monty. Before I can say anything, she nods. I unhook the furled sail, tossing it overboard while Monty hacks away at the mast with her hatchet. Just as the boat disappears beneath the surface, we break the mast free and grab hold. Side by side, we kick, trying to stay on top of the waves. But the current is formidable, and soon the waves are crashing over our heads, and we can hardly find a moment to catch a breath before we are pummeled by more water. Above the splash, I can still hear that maddening chorus, carried on the wind. At moments, the sound seems to coalesce into a song, rising up like a memory from a distant past. Something's not right. The water has begun to turn, spinning us round and round. We kick hard, try to break free of the vortex, but the current is too strong. At the center, it opens up into a dark funnel, plummeting into the depths. The chorus in the sky howls louder than ever. The whirlpool continues to pull us closer towards the black sucking hole, as though the carp's vengeful eye is trying to drag us back beneath the waves. I look at Monty and see her fear, and I wish that she had left me to die rather than being drawn down together. Suddenly, a heavy rope slaps across the mast. Monty and I grab a hold of the line, and it pulls taut, and slowly, we're drawn away from the center of the whirlpool. I glance back just in time to see the mast upend and disappear into the abyss. And when I turn around, I see Huckins holding the rope on the Channel Princess, pulling us to safety.
Help me remember, nothing lasts forever. I left Superior Land, all those months ago, I kind of figured I'd end up getting into some trouble. Thought maybe I'd get lost in the woods, or eat the wrong mushrooms, meet the wrong people. But I'd never have guessed I'd find myself where I am now, sitting at the bottom of the big river with a fellow Youper in the control room of a sunken submarine. Anna's darting back and forth behind me, flipping switches and turning wheels. I'm curious what she's doing, but I can't stop staring at the big metal box taped to the captain's chair and at that note on top that says, "For Huckins." Anna pushes past me and hits a dull yellow button on the console. Suddenly, the floor starts shaking and rust flakes rain down from the ceiling. Anna hits a few more buttons and there's this release, like twisting the lid from a giant jar. "Welcome to the escape pod," Anna says. "You might want to hold on to something." She keeps messing with that board, and the control room, or escape pod, or whatever it is, it breaks free of the caboose. We lurch forward, and I go down, dropping the box as I fall. The lid pops open, and the box's contents spill across the floor. It's a bunch of blue cassette tapes, dozens of them. There are no windows in here. We're blind to the river, except for a blinky screen on the console that I assume to be radar or sonar or some other language I don't understand. I drop to my knees and start picking up tapes. I'm about to stuff an armful in the box when I notice they're labeled. In the one on top, it says 073 Pixley Fink. I dig through the box and sure enough, there's a little radio with a tape deck.
"Kitchen got away with medicine. Stir around and..."
It is her, that trader we met upriver, the one who got swallowed by the howl. Anna's kneeling beside me now, listening intently. "You met Pixley?" I ask. Anna nods, then points at the tapes on the floor. "I met all of them." Together we pick up the scattered tapes. Here's 126, Beth and Kit, and 054, Zolo. Then I notice, in the crook of my elbow, one black tape among the blue. I manage to keep hold on the tapes, but the impact knocks me from my feet and sends me sliding into the wall. Anna crawls up and sits beside me. She reaches over and I think she's going to grab my hand, but she takes that black tape and puts it in the player. Then she does grab my hand.
"Brother, if you're listening to this, you finally caught up with me. Honestly, I wish you hadn't. When I first heard you on the radio, I couldn't believe that you'd somehow gotten wrapped up in all of this. But you're here now, and now you've got my tapes. So it looks like it's you I'm passing the torch to, and you're gonna have to run with it."
"The captain?" I ask. Anna says yes, but I can tell this tape is a surprise to her too.
"I know by now you've seen firsthand what the howl's done to the signal. How it's sucked up the sounds of every broadcaster from here to the headwaters, demolished everything in its path. If it keeps up, the signal will be stamped out permanently."
There's an unsettling sucking sound from outside, and the pod starts shaking violently. Still, neither Anna or I move. We just keep staring at the tape player.
"I was contacted by some folks calling themselves the Delta Congregation. Said they had a plan to bring down the howl, and they needed my help. Those wing nuts, they had convinced all of the broadcasters to head south en masse, making as much noise as possible to lure the howl down to the Delta. They wanted me to bring up the tail end in my sub, the caboose, get it? And at the right moment, they'd go silent, all together. And I'd pop in these tapes and point the caboose out to sea. They said if we could get the thing out there far enough, and if I could make enough noise to tempt the howl, then when it finished sucking up all them tapes, it would have nothing left to feed on, and it would die. Or so the theory went. What they didn't tell me, though, at least not right away, was that the howl would destroy me and the caboose, too. Classic. Hero suicide mission. You couldn't make it up if you tried.
Out of nowhere, the control board starts beeping and blinking.
Now you know all of it.
Anna moves fast, shuts off the tape, tosses the player in the box, and snaps it shut. "Here we go," she says, then grabs my hand and wraps it around an overhead pipe. The pod shoots out of the water and up into the air. And for a moment, I feel light and free, like we might just keep flying, away from the river, clear to Superior Land. At first, I manage to hold onto a pipe, but I lose my grip and hurl through the cabin. When the pod shudders to a halt, I'm lying under the captain's chair, bruised and bleeding from too many places to even begin to catalog. Anna doesn't look so good either, but she hauls herself up and yanks a lever, and a panel in the ceiling blows clean off. Fresh river air floods in. I take in deep gulps. It tastes incredible after so many days in that musty caboose. But my relief washes away when I see what's happening outside. The sky's full of those yellow puff nightmare clouds. Jagged blue bolts zap between them, and all I can hear is the howl. Anna hauls herself out of the pod, lugging the metal box with her, and I follow behind. We are on a small, muddy island. The river's churning violently, spitting brown froth and dead fish, and blue bolts are everywhere. I look at those clouds, then at the river, and then at the box in Anna's hands. And before I can even realize what I'm doing, I take off running toward one of those trees, start climbing as fast as I can. The bolts and static bursts are getting worse and worse, and any second now I'm gonna get zapped, but I keep heading up, branch after branch. I've got to find Huckins and Reed. I've got to give them these tapes. I've got to say goodbye. I'm near the treetop now. The howl is unbearable up here, worming into my ears, threatening to snap the trunk. Below me, I can see dozens of islands and channels between them, and off in the distance, just barely visible through the haze, is a disappearing line of deep blue, the Gulf. I scan the water frantically, but all I see are chunks of driftwood, dented barrels, and upturned flatboats. They're gone. I've lost them. I'm starting to climb down from the tree when I hear what sounds like a cross between a trumpet and a dying llama. I look down and I see Anna running up the mud bank, waving her arms. And just upstream, emerging from behind an island, is the Channel Princess.
I remember the first time I saw the Channel Princess. It had sunk and was collecting silt a few thousand miles upstream. Even at the bottom of the river, it had a certain glow. It looked like it was ready to go, just a little scrubbing and wiring, and it would just take off down the last American highway. I wonder what the Channel Princess will look like years from now. Who might find it on the bottom of the river and where they'll go with it. I feel like my time with this boat is almost over. I can sense the river reaching up and drawing the boat back down. The stern is partially swamped, and I can see socks, tin cans, and wooden spoons sloshing around in the cabin. The cabin door opens, and Envoy Benson joins me in the wheelhouse. Although it's incredible that we've all found our way back to the Channel Princess, we're not really in any better shape than we were. The storm is raging and the windows are so rain-streaked that it's nearly impossible to see much of anything. I can barely make out Reed, Monty, and Anna, who are out on the bow with long poles, pushing pushing away obstacles that threatened to hit the boat as we raced downriver. I try to give the envoy an optimistic smile, but it's a little weak around the edges, and it probably communicates what I'm thinking, that we're taking on water, we're barely ahead of the storm, and it's catching up. The envoy is holding a dented metal case. He sets it on the floor and starts rooting through. He says it's still working and there's something I should listen to. I can see now that the case was full of plastic tapes, recordings of some kind, and the box he's holding is a tape player. Somehow I immediately know that these are from Kobold. I feel anger welling up inside of me, but there's nowhere for it to go. Kobold was probably drowned in a sinking submarine, and whatever twisted plan he was working on is over now. The congregation is gone, my parents are gone, and given the rising water and the sputtering engine of the Channel Princess, our own voyage seems to be almost over.
If you're listening to this, you finally caught up with me.
The envoy starts playing the tape, and Reed steps in from outside. He really looks pretty pale, but even now his expression has a flicker of mischievous excitement about it. We all stand, straining to hear the tape over the howling winds.
So that's it? Now you know all of it. I wouldn't have passed you the congregation's tapes if there was another choice. I'd understand if you make a different decision than I did, but just say hi to the folks if you see them, and tell them I went out fighting an amorphous cloud of doo-wop and static or something. Damn, I gotta go. You should know, you've put in a real good showing out there. I'm proud of you. It's good luck, not goodbye. Don't screw this up.
When the recording is over, the three of us stand motionless. Familiar names popping out from the labels. Driftwood Denny, Guante, and Kendra. We all share a look. I'm not sure what it means, but I think it means that we're here, we've made it this far, and whatever story we could tell starts with those tapes. Starts over 1,000 miles upriver and ends up here. At the mouth of the river, on the deck of a sinking riverboat. We all hear Anna and Monty shouting something from the bow, and as Reed and the envoy jump out on the deck, the rain clears for a moment, and I see a giant wall of water sweeping across the river. The wave is full of logs and the remains of buildings, and it's rolling towards us, blocking out the horizon. The white tip of the wave seems alive with dancing blue light, impossibly high above us. For a moment, the sky is full of the strange electric noise, and I can feel the signal pass through me. And then the feeling is gone, and the wall of water comes crashing down.
ISSIPP. Weirder than the dreams of the weirdos in their dreams.
I come to in a tree, horseshoed around the trunk. I can see an arm and a leg hanging between branches, and I bet they're mine, but I'm not sure. Maybe I was just in this tree the whole time. Maybe I imagined all of that. Finding the Channel Princess, seeing the guys once more, and getting sucked into that wave. My head's pounding. It feels like my brain swallowed river water. But over the roar and crash, I think I hear a voice.
Envoy!
I roll onto my stomach and peer down through the branches. Between an upturned barge and a mountain of mud, I see Anna. She's standing at the base of the tree, waving up at me. I manage to wave back. Turns out that is my arm, but I don't move, not yet. Instead, I close my eyes. I make myself remember those final moments on the Channel Princess, just before the wave hit, And then I rewind all the way back to that first night on the river when the three of us sat around a fire eating fish. I see Huckins and Reed, their faces lit by the flickering flame. They're not speaking. They don't need to. Now, after all that's happened, I know what they were looking for, what we were all looking for. And I know that, in a way, we all found it. I hold on to the image for as long as I can, until the fire fades and their faces disappear into the dark. Then I open my eyes. Anna's still there, waving. And beside her, in the shallows, is a flatboat with two oars. It's pointed upstream, pointed north. I peel myself from the trunk, get my feet under me, and then I look down at Anna and say, "Let's go home."
Drag another log along the sandy bank, lining it up with the others I've collected. The wood is thick and sound, worn smooth by endless days drifting down the river. When I look up from my stockpile, I can see Monty emerging from the forest with an armful of green ivy. We work together, untangling the vines and stripping them of their leaves, and as we lash the logs together, I ask Monty where she wants to go. "Anywhere that has something else to eat besides sour grass and weed runners," she says. I suggest heading back upriver towards North Bend, but Monty shakes her head. "Not on this log job. We'll need to build a proper vessel to make that trip." As she cinches down on the ivy, binding two logs, she suggests that we've come this far, we might as well float a bit further, see where all this water goes. I imagine traveling together down the river, seeing where it takes us. The boys and I, we made that same unspoken pact months ago, and what a wild ride it was. Somehow I know the two of them are still out there. I hope they make it wherever they're going. I take Monty's hand, and together we look downstream. "Suppose we ought to go with the flow," I say. "Besides, home isn't going anywhere."
I'm floating, face up, in the water. It takes me a moment to realize that I'm not in the river. I'm floating in the half-submerged cabin of the Channel Princess. My whole body hurts and my right leg isn't moving. I swim to the front of the boat and claw my way up to the wheelhouse. When I look through the broken windows, I think for a moment I'm looking at complete destruction. There's nothing but water ahead of me, and the storm engulfs the boat on all sides. Then I realize that I'm looking at the end of the river, where it meets the ocean. I stare at the end of the river, my mind blank. And then I feel a pain in my side, and I look down to see the little tape player has floated over to poke me in the ribs. It seems to have survived the crash, the little black wheels inside spinning silently. It takes some time to hotwire the motor and get the radio up and running. All the while, I keep hearing Kobold's words in my head. The congregation's plan to draw out the howl, to starve it, and then bring back the broadcasters, bring back the signal.
There are thousands of stories just...
I start with the first tape I can find.
So that,
when the voice comes on, I can feel a shift in the air around me. The storm breathes and then starts to reform itself. It hears me.
Really interesting when you get three.
I wade through the cabin, collecting all the tapes that are left, and start playing them, one after another, hearing voices from up and down the river.
They got the same gripes. They're trying to figure out what's for supper.
The Channel Princess breaks out of the mouth of the river. Paddle wheels churn into the ocean, spitting smoke and blaring music out into the open air. The tapes are working. The storm is following. and the waves behind the riverboat start to build.
The word hamster.
When I look over my shoulder, the sky is dark. Through the clouds, though, I can see a sliver of a radiation sunset. A thin column of colored light towering over the howling gray ocean. The sound of the river signal in my ears and the storm at my back. I spin the wheel of the Channel Princess, standing on into the current, past the breakers, out into open water.
MISSISIPPI.
This episode of The River Signal was written and recorded by Galen Huckins, Brian Benson, and Reed Lustig. Audio editing by Joel Schupeck. Special thanks to Andrew Huckins, Sarah Golden, Lisa Krauschauer, AC, Cody, Ethan, Nick, and everyone else on the Helen G. Tugboat, Ear Trumpet Labs, and KBOO 90.7. For pictures and video of the riverboat trip, check out riversignal.com. Thanks for listening. Stick around for our final session.
For the last stretch of our trip, from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, there's six of us on the boat, including our friends Lisa and Sarah, and Galen's brother Andrew, who performs under the stage name Kobold. At a quiet harbor in New Orleans, we talk about the experience of traveling the Mississippi and the creation of the River Signal.
What was the very first seed for this trip?
Riding through the graveyard?
Yeah, so let's set it as the graveyard. That makes it particularly dramatic.
So perhaps the first time I started thinking about this trip was when Galen and I were biking. We were taking this alternative route, trying to get off the highway. We climbed way up into the hill. And as we were riding through the graveyard, we were imagining what it would be like to travel on the Princess on the Mississippi River. And I think we had an idea of being a traveling band, perhaps.
Part of that, too, was just the fact that I was thinking about traveling and moving away, and I didn't know what that looked like. And you had had a sense in the past of a trip down the Mississippi River, and you had some vision, I think, for that.
Yeah, barrels and planks.
Key part of it.
So the vision.
The Princess was an upgrade, for sure.
And actually, I think you guys told me about it right after your ride. I bailed on a bunch of professional commitments, and then we started talking about what this would look like. I feel like the first thought was a documentary-ish project, but portraying the world very differently from how it's usually portrayed.
Well, I think, you know, radio was the first thing that seemed like on the table about documenting. When we started talking about documenting it, partially because we had all been doing stuff related to the Steam Radio Syndicate at times together. The Steam Radio Syndicate is this project that is based on this big World War II steam tugboat that is like 150 feet long and that the Channel Princess was tied up next to for several years. And basically we converted the space over time into a sort of radio studio that would host these live radio broadcasts with lots and lots of people telling stories and poems and music and all kinds of stuff. And that was kind of a jumping off point for this project.
Broadcasting a live hour of music and performances from across the decks and causeways of the 150-foot steamship UV-746. Stories of passion, revenge, and fine hardwood furniture. Monday, February 16th at 7.
Well, how did we come to fiction?
Yeah, I have no idea. You guys called me up and you're like, well, it's fictional. I was like, okay.
You You know, we're telling a travel story. And travel stories often, and especially I think with the Mississippi River, are laid out in this way where it is documentary, it's true story, and the people who are telling these stories present their own experience as like what everyone should take away. And what we didn't want to do was come in and tell a story that would be taken at face value as like, this is the Mississippi, this is where it is and how it is. And so going in the fictional direction to make it really clear that this is coming from our experience on the river, but it's also more than that, coming from our choices as storytellers and as travelers.
Yeah, we're not trying to tell anyone how the river is. We were in a town for 2 days. I mean, that tells us almost nothing, but we meet some people there. And the people that we meet were often musicians because that's what we were seeking. And so we get to share something with them, and that's like a very tangible thing that we can share with other people. The magic of that music and the feelings that it inspires and the way that relates to the fictional elements of the episode, I think is something that listeners can really latch on to.
He had this larger world in mind, but every episode would take on the flavor and the personality of the performer that we met. It's fun. I mean, always having that lens of like, what is this story gonna look like this week? Doing research is really a lot of the time just loitering, filtering up how that might play into the story, and particularly with this story, which features a giant carp and a character who's obsessed with said carp and a train car that became a submarine.
And we weren't trying to encode our travel log into this fictional world. Don't try to pull it apart, just enjoy it for what it is, which is a fantasy tale.
The carp is not the Coast Guard.
Now the carp jumps and slides across a sandbank, and a moment later, we plow into that bank at full speed. Benson is still hunched over the radio, scribbling notes even as the waves pitch him from wall to wall.
Above us, the black beaks are swarming, darkening the sky. This time, the carp breaches right in front of me. It goes straight up, like it's full of hot gas. And for a moment, I wonder if it might just...
What was that?
Through the portal, I see churning water. And when I sit down and pull on the headphones, I hear static. It must be getting really deep. Maybe too deep. I think the overall creative process began before we got out on the river. We talked a lot about how we wanted to create this world of the river signal. And we had a pretty broad and vague idea of what the plot was going to look like. In terms of the episodes themselves, they were really based upon the music we recorded. You know, every episode really would begin with meeting up with some musicians and recording their stuff and having a conversation.
One of the coolest parts of the whole trip was that people would just come to the boat and would play music. And then for the week after, we'd be hearing it in our heads a lot and just humming it all the time. And I think that forms a basis for how we'd make an episode too, where we'd take that kind of inspiration and we'd be very steeped in that sound, in that music.
And then we'd eventually sit down all together and listen to the recording again. And then taking those lyrics and also just the tonality of the music, is it a happy song or does it sound tragic, and work it into our plot.
And some performers certainly kind of come with this feeling and with this whole implied landscape in their music. So Guante we recorded in Minneapolis, and he's a spoken word artist. His music, of course, in terms of thinking about it, like lyrics, is very specific. He's talking about a lot of real experiences for him in great detail. So his music also felt like it implied a kind of world or an experience that our episode became about.
The experience of working with Guante was great. All the different things that we were hoping to do, they came across really well in that episode. Using the music in a way that it felt like it fit and drove the plot line. Let people get to know the performer by hearing their voice more often as an actual character in the story, and doing that in a way that didn't feel clunky and felt like it actually fit.
A bit further up the tunnel, there's a figure standing beside a fire. It looks like he's speaking into a walkie-talkie.
don't know why. I'm just the dispatcher, but Seymour said he needs it, a whole bucket full. Yeah, I guess it's actually pretty corrosive.
Families woke to water lapping their foundations and spilling into their cellars below.
Sometimes we hear you tell your children that we're more afraid of you than you are of us.
Workers at the lock scrambled to open the valves, spill the swell, but all the control wheels were locked. A few of the elders climbed up top, tried to get to the tower, but they couldn't get inside. They couldn't even find doors.
Funny, you never tell them about the twisting, deafening darkness mere inches from your skull when you sleep, the orgy of legs and antennae no more than 10 feet from your naked toes.
So all they could do was climb the concrete wall and watch the water swallow their homes.
At every hour of the day.
So our recording setup is really straightforward. We have this hand-built mic, Ear Trumpet Labs in Portland, that captures a lot of sort of a sound in the way you would mic like a bluegrass band, like one mic in the middle, everyone around it.
The woman of my dreams were walking back, slaving in the kitchen, baking me a pumpkin pie, tumbling down the mountain at full speed. She's taking care of me and my every need. Singing like the bluebirds always do until the day's through.
And in some circumstances, we've done things that are more sophisticated or more complicated, but in which case we're rigging up amps and drum sets and all kinds of hullabaloo. I think that people's experience coming out to the boat always had something to it that they'd never done before as a group. Oftentimes it had to do with like the instruments that they'd bring or not bring because of the space, or the kinds of music that they'd play. And we never heard from anybody that they had a tough experience with it. That was something I think was really difficult for us, was figuring out how to try and facilitate that for people, because it was a tough environment, and how to make sure that people had a good experience.
It was just so outside of what I think music too often feels like. But they come out of the boat, and I mean, every time people would comment on just how different it was. And we all love watching live music, but there was something really distinct about being in, you know, a cove just down from the St. Paul Airport, or an island in Missouri, and getting the chance to hear these amazing musicians.
Times twice betraying a chance to find darkness of
different kind. You know, I left my blood ringing. There ain't no God but God. There ain't no God but God. No, there ain't no God but God. I said there ain't no God. You know, there ain't no God but God.
Not always that easy to access. Sometimes we'd find a nice public dock and we'd pull up and the band would come walking down the dock and board the boat and we'd do a concert.
Did that actually ever happen?
Yeah, that happened. But sometimes we'd be anchored out, tied up to some rusting barge pillar.
See, these are the ones I remember.
On the side of a mud bank, off a bike path behind the scrap metal heap, and the band would have to clamber down the mud bank, hop into our leaking rubber raft.
We actually had to build driftwood planks or rock bridges sometimes just to get people down to the leaky dinghy mm-hmm. in the first place.
That's right. Yeah, the whole infrastructure was built in order to transport musicians.
We had one fellow, Will Whitmore, who, in order to get to the session, had to build a bridge over his flooding creek that morning so that he could get over to the Mississippi River.
Which was not an insignificant bridge, which was whole tree trunks being laid down and rolled out.
10 a.m. session.
If I'd have missed out on this, I would have felt really sad. And so, built a bridge, made it here, got across in the dinghy, and now we're doing it, man. It's totally worth it. Yeah, really, it was quite a journey to get here. It's like the stereotypical rock star thing. I mean, that's what you gotta do. Don't mind me, I'm just living here. Don't mind me, I'm just living here. Tear down the mountain, cut the forest clear. Don't mind me, I'm just living here. Pay no attention, I'm just trying to exist. Pay no attention, I'm just trying to exist. I've said too much, now my name's on the list. Pay no attention to me. Oh, I know, I know, I know. Civilizations, they come and they go. Sooner or later, they crumble and fall. We're just here in the middle of it all. We're just here in the middle of it all. Don't mind me, I'm just bleeding now. Don't mind me, I'm just bleeding now. A hand from above cut out my heart somehow. Don't mind me, I'm just bleeding now. Under the radar, hopefully. Under the radar, hopefully. I'm gonna live, live, live till they bury me. Under the radar, hopefully. Oh, I know, I know, I know. Civilizations, they come and they go. Sooner or later, they crumble and fall. We're just here in the middle of it all. We're just here in the middle of it all. Civilizations, they come and they go.
sooner or later they crumble and fall. We're just here in the middle of it all. We're just here in the middle of it all.
We're such an oddity in a sense. We show up and we're on this weird boat. Sometimes in this trip, I've thought about the perspective of fisher people as they see our boat, because they're oftentimes the people who use the waterfront. We'll be there all day and they'll see the boat come up and they'll see us nearly knock into some piling and shout and throw lines around and bump into something and then tie the boat up and get off in our little sinking dinghy and then like bring musicians aboard, and then by evening we're gone.
I think the story of travelers on the Mississippi is something that's well understood and dreamt about by people who live along the river. I think that people seeing the boat was a very understood, exciting thing, because it wasn't that we were doing something unique, is that we were doing something that was very much part of the psyche and the imaginations of the people that we were meeting. We are pretty different than a lot of the people we met, and we were probably pretty weird in a lot of ways. But just the fact that we were on a boat going long distance is something that excites everyone.
Well, so many people would dream into or would fill in blanks about our trip in ways that weren't actually true. You know, we'd come across someone and they'd have this sense of just looking at our boat, you know, here we are, some hairy guys like floating around, and get really excited about it for their kind of their own vision of a trip down the Mississippi. And then if we would get into the details of, well, actually there's this project and it's, you know, we're doing a radio show that's a fictional radio show with musicians and it works like this. And
no, we're not catching a lot of fish. We suck at fishing.
We're not very good at fishing.
We're not partying nearly as much as you think we are.
Yeah.
And we don't know it's the weekend. Forget that so often. Why is everybody out drinking at 11 a.m.? They all seem so oh, right.
People would ask us the same questions.
Do the paddle wheels power the boat?
Where are you guys coming from?
How far are you headed?
How long have you been on the river?
Catch many fish?
Did you build that boat?
Made of steel? Aluminum? Well, that's awesome.
Well, I mean, most of the questions were from people who had just approached the boat. And the boat looks really weird. I mean, like this, you know, aluminum and red and black spaceship paddle wheeler.
When people ask where you're coming from, where you're going, at first the where you're coming from is totally not impressive, but where you're going is, and then it slowly flips-flops.
It felt strange in Baton Rouge being like, we're going all the way to New Orleans. Wow. Like, well, that's actually like a 30-minute drive.
Yeah, and I'll be like, you can make that in the next hour.
You're boring, I'm gonna go watch TV.
Pretty much every Thursday of the week, we would be closing all the windows and the doors on the boat.
Oh, God.
In like 90 plus degree temperatures.
Got so bad.
And then we would proceed to sit in this tiny little space that was surrounded by insulation.
And the bathroom.
Exactly. We were all just dripping in sweat by
like
the end of
every
our
week. Like this wasn't like some experience we had in which it was really hot and it was like, ooh, that was a tough week. It's like every week we're going through this gauntlet of like mosquitoes and 100 plus heat and humidity, sitting in the cabin reading lines. It was grim.
And really enjoyable. Sometimes like someone would start reading their lines and then someone would stop them and say, hey, you need to sound a little bit more happy.
Boat trips and boats imply this like system for everything. And I think to some degree we've developed that in this trip, what knots to tie and where to tie them and when to do this and how we pull into harbors and how we handle heavy wind and how we anchor. That is our invention, because none of us are experienced mariners. Like, we don't know the actual way to do a lot of things. That I'm sure anyone who knows their way around a boat properly would come and be like, that is a ridiculous way to do that thing.
I think swimming was a pretty big extracurricular activity throughout the summer. We spent most days, I think. We'd heard that we weren't going to be able to swim much, or shouldn't maybe swim much below St. Louis, but we still did.
Yeah, swimming never stopped.
Nope.
We've constantly been figuring out how to best relate to one another. For me, it's worked out really well, and I think that we have very different strengths to it. And there is something distinct about being in a tiny box with people for long periods of time. It makes you interact in ways that you would never interact with someone, that are really difficult oftentimes, but that really tell you a lot about that person and get you to understand them.
And doing all the things in the tiny box that we've been doing over the course of the summer, I am fully confident that I will never, ever have an experience like this with two people again. We've all met so many people and encountered so many new places together. Excited about seeing what everybody is up to and also hopefully continuing to work together.
I was nervous starting this trip, knowing the size of the boat. I was worried about the confined space, and I never could have imagined how sustainable this was. It's not like I got to New Orleans and was like, yes, finally we're there, like I can get off this boat and get away from these guys. And if for some reason this river was twice as long, we would have had a great time continuing.
Once you're buddies, you're always buddies. I always tell people never hold a grudge more than 5 years. Well, I have lived here on this river all my life. I ain't no freshly fallen log. And on this river I have seen some big sights. I've been stuck down in some bog. I'm just an old piece of driftwood, I'm afloat down. I might just stop around your town. If I could just bob around those big barges in between, well, I hope I can make it on down to New Orleans. Yeah, I hope I can make it on down to New Orleans. I hope I make it down, hope I make it down. I hope I make it down. Yeah, I hope I can make it on down to New Orleans. Yeah.
Thanks to everyone who made this project possible. It's been an unforgettable summer, and we really appreciate your support. We'll be releasing more recordings from the trip and talking about future projects through our website at riversignal.com.
Proud co-sponsor of the Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival, September 26th, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Park Rose High School West Athletic Field in Portland. The Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival remembers and celebrates the art, music, personality, and legacy of the great Kaw Creek musician Jim Pepper. This year's performers include One Heart, featuring Jan Michael Looking Wolf, the Delbert Anderson Trio, Four Directions Drum, Big B, and many more. Again, that's the third annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival, September 26th, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Park Rose High School West Athletic Field, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a feature-length documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein on Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21 in Portland. Gaining Ground tells the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practice so they can feed their local communities sustainably grown produce and grains. The documentary interweaves experiences of urban farmer activists, large farms in transition, and small family farmers. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st, at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are about to cross the border.